This is Monocle on Design, our weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. On today's show, we meet the founder of Lagos Design Week, an event showcasing creative talent and craft from Nigeria, as well as the wider African continent. We also hear about a collaboration between celebrated British lamp maker Anglepoise and the National Trust, plus some words of wisdom from Joana Astolfi, one of Portugal's most exciting retail and interior designers. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Design Week Lagos is underway. Started in 2019, the event aims to platform contemporary talent from across the African continent and showcase local materials and techniques. This show's producer, Maylee Evans, caught up with the festival's founder, Titi Ogoferi, to find out more.
It's my life work to actually champion contemporary African design. I began my career as an interior designer, product designer in Lagos, and like many of my counterparts, I've spent most of my life sourcing from everywhere else in the world, just sourcing from Italy, from the States, and just thinking about the way the industry has evolved. If you think about music, fashion, literally the artistic movement, you'd notice that most of them have gained global recognition, but when it comes to African design, a lot of people don't know much about what's going on here. And I looked at, that was a huge gap. I looked at what was going on, because I mean, I live in the continent. Because I live here, I see it every day. And you see people doing amazing things and no one knows what they're doing. You just get them when you need to do stuff. You're okay, I'm trying to do this. And we're naturally creative. So I thought that was a gap that needed to be filled. So for interiors, for product design, and is an important, for me, it's an important work because you have so many creatives designing for themselves. I mean, there are other issues we have, like we don't have manufacturers, but they design and produce this work. So for me, it was just something that needed to be done.
And I want to jump to, so this year's theme is Design Revolution. So I wonder what kind of changes, what kind of shifts in the world are the designers featured this year looking to dream up or to instigate in the future?
So one of the things that most people have seen when it comes to African design is more traditional African design. That's what most people know. In fact, I'll just pause and talk about the Ankara fabric. So the Ankara fabric are the patterns, they actually, like I said, they're Dutch. They're the fabrics that a lot of people portray African wax, you know, the African wax. That's what they've been calling it. But it's more bold colors, more patterns that are not necessarily geometric. Some of them are fluid. So I would say Ankara fabrics are, they call them the African wax or Holland wax. They're 100% curtain, but they have lots of vibrant patterns. They're really colorful and they're associated with Africans. They've been there for, lots of designers actually use them. I've seen Louis Vuitton use them. I've seen lots of international brands use them and actually portray as African. Growing up, I see a lot of people say Ankara fabric is African, is actually not African, is Dutch. And I know that it was something that was done, I think it failed in the Philippines and it became popular in Africa, but that's actually not the identity. Just kind of thinking through as an African that lives in Africa, sometimes we laugh, sometimes you look and say, why do they, have you seen a lion? Have you seen animals? Do we jump on trees? And I mean, we get on Twitter, we do everything, we're just developing, but we are not what most people think. And for me, it was just something that a lot of people were breaking out of what they felt people were already portraying African design as. I would say, so when you see a lot of people put colors, so they just say Africa and let's just splash a lot of colors. But there are lots of neutrals. If you know much about the African colors, there are lots of earthy colors, beige, just grays. you know, just not what people think. So we had a lot of designers just saying, you know what, let's actually show, because it's very easy for you to say, oh, but that's not what it is, but what is it? So you have the opportunity to actually show, break out of what people think, and now show what you want people to see. You want to show them more neutral colors, clean lines, geometric patterns. So that's really what we're showing. We're, even though we know that we have the traditional craftsmanship, but we all live in a digital world today. We can draw influences from the past, but we're living in this world. So we want to be able to showcase that.
So the African continent is abundant in raw materials. There's bamboo, there's leather, copper, brass, bronze. But much of these materials are exported. I wondered how Design Week Lagos is maybe showcasing the potential for these local materials and maybe inspiring designers and how they could be used and for more of it to stay within the continent rather than sort of be flown here and there across the globe.
A lot of the raw materials we have are taken aboard. Why? Because one, there's not much research done on these different materials. So a lot of people don't know how to use them. That's one. Secondly, the whole process. There's a whole process that has to do with manufacturing. Everywhere else in the world, there's a clear value chain, but in Africa, there's none. So you find out you have someone that is trying to design something, and they have to kind of use everything. You have to take the materials, you have to understand them. So it's like you're a jack of all trades, master of none. So most of them actually struggle. Also, the manufacturing is a really, really, really major challenge because for some reason, we haven't really developed the manufacturing. We've not had like a real industrial revolution. So it's just easy for people to design and just take them to Italy and just take them or just bring them back to Africa and we buy. I mean, let's use leather, for example. In Africa, we like all the designer bags and things, but some of these major brands actually come to Kano, get the leather and take them and we buy them as finished goods. The reason this happens is because, like I said, they're only selling the raw materials. That's it. No one is doing anything with them. We have a few people struggling, but budget is a constraint. Manufacturing is a constraint. There's just so many things that have worked against us in the past. But right now we have a lot of, funding coming in. We have a lot of partnerships. We're taking designers to Milan next year for the Salone, the 60th anniversary. And for us is more trying to promote the work of these designers, give them opportunities.
And you mentioned earlier that as part of the Design Week, you're also, I guess, launching the new Netflix documentary series Made by Design. So that's highlighting architects, interior and product designers, Nigerian designers, I believe, just to check, is it? Or is it across the African continent?
So the first episode, we just focused on Nigerian designers because, like I said, we started that during the lockdown, so we couldn't move. So it was just looking at what people were doing and just trying to document their work. Right now, we've been able to publish about 25 different books on different designers, and we thought film was a good area that we haven't looked at. And so for us, we partnered with an award-winning producer to come up with 13 episodes with 13 different designers, from architects, product designers, and interior designers. That's what we did.
And I suppose, finally, what do you hope visitors, whether they're joining in person or virtually, what do you hope they take away from this year's event?
For me, it's important that people see the rich history of the craftsmanship of the Africans. We're focused on Africa as a whole. It's interesting because, I mean, Africans have worked in the past, but trying to bring everyone together with our language barrier, you know, we have the French speaking, we have the English, Portuguese speaking, Arabic speaking, just with bringing everyone together. We have 21 different African countries coming in. And for us, we want them to be able to express from their perspective, this is Africa. This is what Africa is. And for me, that's Design Revolution from the African perspective.
That was Titi Ogunferi there. She was speaking to Monocle's Maile Evans. Design Week Lagos runs until the 31st of October. Now, we look at a new project by lamp maker Angle Poise, the storied British brand which created its first lamp in 1932, is collaborating with the UK's National Trust to release a special edition sage green version of its famous 1227 lamp. At least £15,000 of the proceeds will then go towards the upkeep and renovation of the Homewood, a beautiful 1930s modernist villa nestled in the heart of the Surrey countryside. To find out more about the project and the importance of reuse and renovation, we spoke to Angle Poise's managing director, Simon Terry.
The whole factory and the whole beginnings was actually started in 1855, which was by my great-great-grandfather, who was called Herbert Terry. And he basically came up with the idea of bringing spring making together in a central place from a factory. At the time, it was more piecemeal. It was things you did at home. And he brought it in and started to grow this sort of factory that, and business that then grew through Charles, my great-grandfather, all the way through to Norman, my grandfather, to my father, John. And I'm now the fifth generation in that business, but it became a very large spring maker and it was very known for being able to make very special springs. So it sort of stayed with springs and pressings really. But then in the 1930s, a very brilliant car engineer came along called George Carmody, who came up with this new method of basically balancing a weight and space and then developed this concept around a light, which was the angle poise. And it's basically required some very special springs, which are called constant, it's a constant tension spring, which means it's got the same tension, you know, when it's closed as when it's open. I actually have one in my hand, which you can probably hear me doing it. I always carry the spring around with me to sort of connect me to and to remind me who I am and where I came from. But we were very clever with spring making, and that's what linked us to the angle poise, and that's where the whole lamp was born. But at the time, it was very different. I mean, if you look at the history books, nothing would look like it before. It looked like this strange mechanical item where absolutely, you know, function is the primary, and had a few Art Deco cues and stuff in its design. The National Trust is obviously, you know, the largest conservation charity in Europe and has a massive influence on ensuring properties and places stay for future generations. So we were taking that approach, and we've always mended products. So we have products now that have been going since the 1930s. We still mend, we still repair, and we've been finding more and more that we've been doing that and formalizing that process. So this was also part of launching a lifetime guarantee last year on all our products, which is a massive statement of intent for us, you know, and very unusual. No other company has done that. I can't find another lighting or electrical company that's done something. But we did it because we felt it was the right thing to do. And, you know, if we were saying we make products that last a lifetime, we need to put our money where our mouth is and give a guarantee that supports that. So it was very much about, we felt it was shared values of the National Trust, and we've always loved them as an organization and supported them. And this was just a lovely way of celebrating coming together and doing something that was important. The collaboration to start off with is a product we've built around our original 1227 collection, which was designed by George Carmody in the 1930s. And what we've done is come up with a beautiful colour that's a sort of sage green colour that I'd say obviously represents nature quite nicely and reflects that. It's a great colour to start with, but with a very subtle detailing of the oak from the National Trust in the bridle. So it's a very subtle piece of design there, just a little nip just to give it a little identity. And that we've done as a product that we can obviously sell through partners. But what we're doing is then using the money from that to raise money to support a very particular house from the National Trust collection. Now that the house involved here is called the Homewood House, and it was designed by an architect called Patrick Gwynne in, I believe, 1938, which was kind of obviously Anglepoy is 1933, so there's a similar sort of time there. And we just love the house because it was a real modernist house. It's one of two properties in the National Trust portfolio that is a modernist house. But we have a real connection with modernist design through, you know, people like Margaret Howell, who are massive followers of modernism. And it's very important to us to support that. And obviously Kenneth is very much a modernist designer as well. So it's a big part of Anglepoy is supporting that genre, if you like, that period of design history. We need to reflect on properties and buildings through the generations, and they all tell different stories, and those stories need to be told for future generations. So, you know, I'm personally a massive supporter of modernist buildings, and, you know, they are under a lot of pressure in this country around, you know, there's lots of stories of them being not supported, not recognised as serious architecture, being pulled down and all of these things. So I think it's wonderful that the National Trust has taken a property under their wing like this and are really, you know, looking after it, nurturing it and ensuring it can last for future generations. I think we're all starting to look at things now and we realise we can't just keep throwing things away, you know, in that there's precious resources. And I think for me, a line we always have is, you know, no product should be designed or destined for landfill. And I think, you know, it's so important that we extend the life of things, we use them for longer, we repair them, because it's just the right thing to do. And yeah, there's a lot of initiatives on recycling things, but fundamentally, the best thing we can possibly do is just use things for longer. And, you know, I think also a lot of this sort of mindset is pushed on to consumers to say, consume things like this. But I think it's up to producers. I think it's up to makers to step up and give people the right options. But I think actually it's the companies that are actually stepping up and doing things. So we very much have started to formalise that. So we are formally setting up, you know, repair services for all our old lamps. So up to 100 years old, and we repair them, we look after them. So that is very important, I think, to show the world that you're not just talking about it, and that you're acting and that you're doing it. I'm a custodian of this business. So my moral obligation and duty is to pass this business on to my children and for them to pass it on to their children's children in a better state than I found it. We kind of follow the All Blacks a lot. It's about leaving the shirt in a better place. And I'm very proud to do that. What an opportunity to do that. So for us, it's sort of built into our DNA. But the reality is, you know, if you don't do this and act on this now, it's going to be forced on people anyway, because we are living beyond our means. And I don't think consumers want to keep throwing things away. So if you have a situation where a product breaks now because it's not made properly, then you can't send someone a new one and say, throw away the old one, because people are going, well, I don't want to throw it away. That I feel guilty doing that. So I think makers and designers need to really address this and understand that consumers are changing, they are shifting, and they have a voice, and they will vote with where they spend their money. So if we don't change ourselves now, which is the right thing to do, it will become legislation.
My thanks to Simon Terry. Finally, on this week's programme, we head to Portugal to speak with architect and artist Joana Astolfi. Her eponymous Lisbon-based practice is known for its creative approach to retail design and has worked extensively with French luxury brand Hermès. Astolfi recently sat down with Monocle's Ivan Carvalho in her Lisbon home to recount her distinctive approach to design.
One of the things that I really love doing and that Studio Astolfi has become known for is window displays. So it's this world of visual merchandising, working with this balance, this very delicate balance between the product that we're celebrating from different brands and the mise-en-scène that we create around that product or around those products. There's a lot of scenography involved. There's a very poetic and theatrical side to this work. And it's a real cross between working a space and working objects. So it kind of also combines these two areas that I try to cross constantly in my work, which is architecture and art. And we've been working with the top brands for the last 8 years. Our main client is Hermès. We represent Portugal in the Hermès world of window display. We were doing four seasons a year, which is a lot, responding to a different theme every year and creating a narrative in the eight windows of the Lisbon shop, which is very demanding. And every year, every season, we have to kind of try to surprise ourselves, to surpass ourselves. So it's a real big challenge. This year, we're doing Spain and Portugal. So we're doing six shops, which is also quite a big thing. We've also worked with national brands that have reinvented themselves, like Klaus Porto or Viúva Lamego. We've also done window displays for them to tell their story, the story of their heritage. What are they known for? How they evolved? How, in the case of Viúva Lamego, it kind of almost broke down the factory and now it's revitalizing itself. It's in a rebirth moment. And all of this we tell through the window, through the story that we create in the windows, okay? So in the studio, we have two different physical spaces. We have an atelier where the architects and interior designers work, and we have a big workshop where the artisans, artists, sculptors, technicians, where all of that part of the team works. And we, for the window displays that we create, we always start with a concept, with a narrative that can be translated into one, two, three, five windows, depending on the size of the shop. And then we explore this narrative through different materials, through the materiality, through the color palette, through the way, through conceptual twists that we do with different materials. Sometimes we do the window displays all in paper. Like one of the seasons for Hermès, I wanted to work just with book pages. So we bought 800 books, old books with yellowish pages, and all the mise-en-scène, all the scenarios that we created were all built from these books. We carved the books, we cut the books, we sculpted the books, we took out the pages and created sculptures with the papers. And in the midst of all this, we integrate the object, the products, and we celebrate them and bring them out, let them breathe in this mise-en-scène. We really love and we're very connected to craftsmanship at the studio. So we work with carpenters, with cabinet makers that build in a very beautiful and sculptural way. They work wood, different patines of wood, different types of wood, different driftwood to noble wood. This work and this involvement, the impact that a window can have, the window is a passport to the brand itself. It tells the story of the brand. So it can have a huge impact on the communication of the brand. So in terms of visual merchandising, this is definitely one of the things that I most enjoy doing, creating these small scenarios, these mise-en-scènes. It takes a lot of work and a lot of filtering of ideas to get to the final concept, but it's definitely worth the challenge and the journey. This fusion between architecture and arts, it really characterizes the language that I've been umbilically creating for the last 10, 15 years with Studio Astolfi. And I don't think in Portugal, there's not many studios, if probably not another studio, that is doing this cross. For me, it's very important. For example, in spaces that we work, like São Lourenço do Barrocal, it's a farmscape retreat in the 2.5 hours from Lisbon, beautiful hotel and farm. There's the restaurant there where the client asked us to create a big wall, so an 8 meter long wall or more, 10 meters, an installation that would tell the story of that farm that has been in the family for over 200 years. And what we did was we created our first big cabinet of curiosities. We designed the whole cabinet, so it's a carpentry work. And we spent 2-3 weeks in the farm looking for objects, photographs, bones of birds, feathers, jewelry from his grandmother, letters that his grandfather used to write to his children when he was away in Africa. So many different things that tell that narrative. So we created an installation wall, basically, with more than 300 typologies of objects that have the patine of time, the memory built in them, that when people come to Bechukal, it's one of the things that most strikes them is to be able to appreciate and take their time looking at each of the objects on this cabinet of curiosities and understand a little bit of the story behind Bechukal. Sometimes we're invited by architects like Eduardo Souto Moura or Valsacina. We're invited by them to work on the interior design of a project that they are doing, a big project, for example, hotel and houses, big houses, 500 square meter houses. That's what Studio Astolfi is most known for, is for creating interior ambiences, interior moods. So many times we work closely with architects that design, let's call it the architectonic object, the structure, the skeleton. And then we come in and we help to finalize the selection of the finishes for floors, for walls, for the color palette, for spatial dividers, for cabinet walls, etc. And then we come in with the layer of the decor. That's all the design of the furniture. The selection, some pieces we draw, some like tables, lamps. Sometimes we choose them from different brands that we work with and we select them and we buy them. I'm interested in working obsolete spaces. And in Lisbon, we have a lot of that. A lot of buildings that are completely abandoned. And now more and more, there are investors that are taking over these buildings and refurbishing them completely. So this is when we are called, is to come in, usually in the phase of the whole interior fit out of these spaces. And most of these are transformed into hotels, small boutique hotels, luxury housing, or retail and residential. So this idea of coming back to making houses again, because I had stopped doing houses for a while, it's the most demanding project for me, is designing someone's house, because it's as intimate as you can get to a client. And you end up designing, and the way that we work, that we like to design everything to the maximum detail with all full rigor, we end up designing their full clothes closet, to the drawer where he puts his socks, to the doorknob of each drawer. I mean, it becomes obsessive almost. And then it's a never-ending story. Where do you finish? Where do you finish the line? There's always something else that you can do. And the client gets enthusiastic. He wants more. We want to give more. We work our drive as passion. It's, you know, we give in ourselves completely to the project. And this can be, sometimes it can go a little bit, you know, too far. But just to talk about this idea, this story of coming in to a space that has been forgotten, that is almost ill, that we have so many in Lisbon, and giving it a new life through the creation of a contemporary interior, but that respects the history that is so clear through its walls, through the materials that the space has, from stone to old wood walls with the old forms of construction, that sometimes we just break them through, but we leave traces of the existing history behind that building. So the bones of the building, we try to leave them there. And then we start playing. We start mixing materials. We bring in wicker, we bring in wood, we bring in stone. We like to work with natural materials and mix them. And then there's a whole world with the colors, the in-between colors that we choose, to the green that is not completely green because it has a little bit of gray in it, or the red earth that is not really red, but it's not rose, it's in between. So all these intemporal, eternal colors, as I call them, because you never get sick of these colors, they are also part of this narrative and part of the story.
My thanks to Joanna Astolfi. And that's all the time we have on today's show. If you're keen for even more design-related listening, then catch our 5-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. It airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced by Maylie Evans and Charlie Filmer Court and edited by Chris Ablakwa. My thanks to our researcher, Nick Manise. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.